From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Roseanne Arnold about her life, her TV show, and the Kiss episode that she said almost didn't get aired. Also today, the Middle East peace talks are in limbo in the wake of last week's massacre. The killer was part of an extremist militant group of settlers. We'll talk to an expert on Israel's radical right, Ehud Sprinzak. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new TV series, The Birds of Paradise and The Road Home. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has signed an executive order reviving a trade provision that could pressure other countries to open their markets to American goods. U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor says the president has revived Super 301. That's a trade provision that establishes a list of closed foreign markets. The United States can eventually use the law to impose trade sanctions on other countries. Cantor says although Japan holds the biggest trade imbalance with the United States, the 301 law isn't aimed only at Tokyo.
This is a message to any country whose practices would constitute a serious barrier to U.S. exports. The failure to allow open markets for competitive U.S. products around the world costs us jobs. Japan is unique among developed nations in maintaining closed markets. Therefore, this procedural mechanism known as Super 301 could have an impact not only with Japan but with other nations as well.
The list of nations will be drawn up from a report issued March 31st on trade practices around the world. The top PLO negotiator is meeting with State Department officials today and with Secretary of State Warren Christopher tomorrow. Christopher has kept in touch with PLO leader Yasser Arafat since last week's massacre at a mosque in Hebron on the West Bank. There are indications that the PLO has told Christopher that it will continue peace talks with Israel, but the PLO has not said that publicly. The prosecution has rested its case in the murder trial of anti-abortion activist Michael Griffin. Griffin is accused of shooting Dr. David Gunn during a protest at his Florida abortion clinic last year. Debbie Elliott has the story.
The final witness for the prosecution was Escambia County Corrections Officer Brenda Fuque. Fuque testified that during a visit the day after Dr. Gunn was killed, she overheard Griffin talking with his wife about the shooting.
He said that he didn't do it for any notoriety or any public recognition.
Did he say anything else?
Yes, sir. He said he killed him because of his beliefs and convictions. And if he had to go to jail for the rest of his life to save a baby, it would be worth it.
Fuque did not come forward until a week before the trial began, but testified she didn't report the conversation sooner because she didn't know if it was privileged communication. Defense lawyers had agreed not to object to the jailer's testimony in exchange for the state no longer seeking the death penalty. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Pensacola, Florida.
A two-day strike by steelworkers in three states ended this morning with a contract settlement. The Wheeling Pittsburgh Steel Corporation and the United Steelworkers clinched an agreement overnight. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 5 points at 3,826. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. A Lebanese man accused of shooting four Orthodox Jewish students on Tuesday has been denied bail by a New York judge. One of the victims has been declared brain dead. A second is not expected to survive. The lawyer for Rashad Baz says authorities have arrested the wrong man. But prosecutors say Baz was identified in two lineups and made statements in tape and in writing. Baz is charged with 15 counts of attempted murder and several assault and weapons charges. Two other suspects will be charged in the case as well. The United Nations Special Representative in the former Yugoslavia wants more peacekeepers in the region. Yasushiya Kashi has called for more than 10,000 new troops. Richard Carruthers reports from Zagreb.
To maintain fragile ceasefires, Akashi said the UN needs more than 4,500 troops in Sarajevo and a further 6,000 in central Bosnia. He said the lukewarm and negative responses so far to requests for reinforcements were profoundly disturbing, but he had no doubt the international community would now pay the price for a durable peace. UN Force Commander Jean Cot was less optimistic. There was a risk, he said, of losing everything that had been won if he didn't get his soldiers immediately. The nations who could provide those troops, he said, could be counted on one hand. First the United States, then Britain and France. General Cot said Washington's reluctance to contribute troops until an enforceable peace deal was signed was a strange and not very courageous idea. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
The leaders of a South African coalition of conservative blacks and pro-apartheid whites say they might participate in the country's upcoming elections. But members of the Freedom Alliance say they want foreign mediators to settle differences between them and the South African government and the African National Congress. The ANC has agreed to this, but a mediator hasn't been selected. The Freedom Alliance also wants the elections delayed. The government and the ANC have rejected this demand. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Roseanne Arnold, may have one of the most public, private lives in show business. Now she has a new memoir that tries to bring together all the seemingly contradictory sides of her personality. It's called My Lives. This has been a big week for her. The book is out. Her husband Tom's new show premiered last night. And the night before, ABC broadcast a controversial episode of Roseanne. When the episode opens, Roseanne and her sister meet Nancy's new girlfriend Sharon, played by guest star Mariel Hemingway. The couple invites Roseanne and Jackie to come with them to a gay bar. And at the bar, Sharon gives Roseanne a big kiss. I asked Roseanne if it was her idea to set an episode in a gay bar.
That was my husband's idea. The whole episode was Tom's idea. I didn't want to do it.
Why didn't you want to do it?
Well, because I was thinking, I didn't know if it was appropriate or not. And I felt it was going to be big controversy. And I didn't know if I wanted to get into that. But once my husband was into it, he went to the network and gave them the outline, and they said no. So he ordered a script done anyway, and they said no to the script. And then he filmed the show anyway, and they said no to that. And then he kind of politicked, and it's because of my husband that it was on the air, and it's because of him that I did it. And now I'm really, really proud that I did, and I feel it was an important show and an important subject to tackle. I didn't feel too much of the controversy. I thought everybody was pretty much on our side, and that was nice.
Was there a lot of controversy between how the kiss should be shot and what should be shown and what angle and this and that?
No, my husband did that, mm-hmm. And you know, we would never hopefully insult our audience on purpose anyway, or be prurient or pander. So we just did it, I think, in the best non-lurid way that we could.
There are two gay characters who are regulars on the show, the characters played by Martin Mull and Sandra Bernhardt.
Yeah.
Was there ever a problem with that? Were you ever told that would be too controversial or that some of the viewers would be offended by it? Did you have to fight for that, is what I'm asking?
Yeah, we did. And my husband, Tom, he did most of that. I wanted to have the gay characters and wanted them to not be caricatured. And I wanted them to have, like, you know, loving relationships and, like, be normal human beings instead of, you know, some other shows that have gay people that just sit in their rooms and get beat up. And so we wanted to show that. And, yeah, it was a little bit of a lot of bustle, but people there, they like to make a big deal over little things, and then they end up doing what you want usually anyway. But they first go to the press and stir everything up. I think they do that so people will watch. And I'm not a fan of that technique, but that's the business I'm in.
Roseanne Arnold is my guest. She has a new memoir called My Lives. Now, on the acknowledgments page, you thank your doctors.
Yeah.
Not a typical acknowledgement type of thank you. Why'd you thank them?
Because they have helped me so much.
What kind of doctors?
Oh, all kinds. Psychiatrists mostly.
And you thank my dolls. And I wasn't sure whether that was an affectionate term for real people in your life or whether you collect dolls.
I have a rather large doll collection of probably over 200 dolls. And I pick each one of them because they remind me of a part of me. And I have them all arranged in a great big circle around the desk where I write, circle after circle, a small circle, then a bigger one, and then a bigger one, and then a bigger one, and they totally ring the room. And I like to go in there and turn the lights low and listen to music and just look at the dolls. And it's calming, I guess, like some people have fish tanks for that. They have given me a lot of good feelings.
Uh-huh. Let me do a little bit of Roseanne, the early years. Mm-hmm. You grew up in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
Predominantly Mormon area. But you're from a Jewish family.
Yes, but I was raised as a Mormon.
Well, how did your family end up in Salt Lake City? How did your family end up in Salt Lake City?
Well, they were merchants, and they came there because it was a time of a bustling boom town. Copper mines and this and that and the other, and they were merchants, so they went to where the business was from Kansas City and from Minneapolis.
Now your father ended up selling crucifixes door-to-door, not a typical profession for a Jewish man.
Yeah.
How did he end up doing that?
Well, he and my grandfather, it was my grandfather's, they were kind of, I guess, a con man, and they did the door-to-door scam thing. Like, for an extra $5, my grandfather would bless their holy water. He told them he was a Greek holy man, and they believed him. And one time they asked my dad, how come your father's Greek, but you're Jewish? And my father said, I converted. But they were just kind of flim-flam men, but that's how they made their living, was selling crosses and 3D pictures of Jesus that when you walked by him, his eyes closed, or else first he was standing real nice in a robe, and then when you walk by, he'd get crucified. The two things go flash back and forth.
So did you have a lot of that in your house?
Oh, yeah, we had those things everywhere. All the things they sold were all through the house. I used to look at those pictures and get really scared.
Well, that's the funny thing. There's so much of that, of, you know, like biblical art and pictures of Jesus on the cross that really terrify kids.
Oh, yeah. Well, it terrified me because I didn't hear of him till I was older. I didn't hear who that guy was.
You didn't know that this was Jesus?
No. I didn't know who the hell it was.
So you thought this was just like some guy who was being terribly punished?
Yeah, I thought, uh-oh, you better stay in line because you never know what could happen to you.
My guest is Roseanne Arnold. She's written a new memoir called My Lives. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Roseanne Arnold is my guest. She has a new memoir called My Lives. You left home when you were, what, 18? Or how old were you when you left home?
Well, when I left home for good, I was about 18, yeah.
And you went to Denver.
Yeah.
Worked at a feminist bookstore.
Well, that was way later.
Oh, that was way later?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. I went to Denver to have a baby who I gave up for adoption.
Right. This was, I think you've written that the first time you had sex, you got pregnant.
Yeah.
So you gave up the baby for adoption.
Yeah.
A child who you later met when she
turned
18.
Yeah, 5 years ago, we were reunited.
Did you think, oh, my life is over now, when you got pregnant? Because that's, you know, I know I grew up on those movies where when the teenager gets pregnant and she's not married and she isn't going to be married in the near future, it's shame and it's the end.
Well, there was a lot of shame to it for my family. My father spit on me, and they acted as if I had shamed them in a neighborhood where you know, pretty much everybody was either a drunk or some kind of weirdo, and I didn't understand that. But so I did not want to have that baby around them, and I didn't feel that I had any help there or any way to do it, or I would have kept her. And I did try to, but I had no way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel it was the end of my life. I guess I have always known somewhere that I was going to, you know, be successful someday and have a lot of money, and I knew I'd be famous too, I think.
So how did you start working at a feminist bookstore in Denver?
Actually, it was my sister that got me involved in it. She went to this bookstore for a support group for lesbianism support group. She was just coming out. And so I, you know, went over there with her, and I ended up to, I think there was a couple other straight women there, and I thought it was a cool place because it had all these books, and I've always loved books, and it had books from written by women from all over the world, every culture. It was just so cool, and I got involved because of the books and because it was a reference place where people called and said, where can I go to find this kind of help? And, you know, it was something I did for a few hours a day for free, you know, in a collective. And then it got more and more, I got more and more involved in it as it went along, and until I began to do stand-up.
Was there a connection between the bookstore and getting involved in stand-up?
Oh, absolutely.
What was it?
Well, it was all the feminist theory and stuff that I was reading. I was like, my God, people don't know this. People do not know this. They've never heard this. It's kind of censored. It's secret stuff. It's sinister wisdom, and I thought, well, I want to find a way to bring it mainstream, to bring it to everybody. And so, well, my comedy came out of that.
How did you develop your early domestic goddess idea? You know, that you didn't want to be called a housewife or homemaker. You were a domestic goddess.
Well, it actually came from this book called Fascinating Womanhood by Helen B. Andelin, which my mother was reading sometime in the 60s, and I opened it to this chapter that was entitled Domestic Goddess, and it was telling you how to be a domestic goddess so that, you know, your husband would buy you a toaster or whatever, you know. And, you know, it's kind of preceded the wrapping and saran wrap total woman thing. Yeah, so you're supposed to keep your house really clean and, you know, then your husband would treat you better or something. Domestic Goddess. I thought it was so funny. I'd always loved that name. So that's when I said it was like kind of like somebody who, what I had in my head was that I would say it like somebody who really didn't get what it means but thought it meant something else. And that's what really clicked with a lot of people.
And how did the rest of your act start falling into place?
Well, once I got the domestic goddess part, that was like the context. And then I just began to write jokes that filled in that context and stayed within that persona.
What I often think about some comics is that the stuff that makes them insecure in real life, they can really use to their advantage on the stage. Was it that way with you?
I guess in some way, I don't know. I thought mine was more of a mission for women.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was on a mission from God to save women and to enlighten them for feminism in the beginning.
Well, how'd you go over?
So I didn't think it was just me, or else I wouldn't have had the guts to do it.
Well, how'd you go over in the clubs in the early days?
Well, the first time I ever went on stage, I did really well. I'd had a very political act then. It was not the domestic goddess act. And the second time I went on stage, people just freaked out and were booing me. And one woman turned her chair around so that her back was towards me. And so I thought, well. And then I got kicked out of this clubs. They wouldn't let me perform, so I had to go perform at these punk bars and coffee houses and Unitarian churches and all these alternate places to perform. And now looking back, you know, I'm really glad that I did, that I didn't have to give into that club mentality, because, you know, otherwise my act would be like everyone else's is, and their acts are all pretty much the same. But I got to develop in biker bars and gay bars and punk bars, and, you know, they'd just throw me out in the middle of the crowd with no microphone in the punk bar, surrounded by kids slam dancing, and I'd have to figure out a way to get them to listen to me. And I did. And I learned a lot of things, you know, from getting to have those experiences that I probably would not have learned in the regular clubs.
No, could you use the same material in a biker bar as in a gay bar, as in a punk bar?
I learned how to do that. And that was another thing that I'm grateful for, because I really learned to speak a lot of different languages to a lot of different groups of people. And I think that that also shows in my show, that I have brought that to the show, and that's why it has such a great cross current of people who watch.
You write in your new book, My Lives, that during the period you were working in the feminist bookstore and starting to do stand-up, you were also working the streets and picking up audience members for sex and money. Now, how did that connect with the feminist part of your life, if you were picking up people and paying, charging them for sex?
I think, have you read my book?
Yeah.
My book is about the various parts of me, and that is, I was also, that chapter you're quoting from, I was also then going home and, being a housewife and a mother and making dinner every night and writing for a heavy metal magazine and doing a couple other really way out there things. That's how I have always lived my life, because there are many, many different parts inside of me who were, until recently, unaware of each other.
So you're saying these things didn't connect?
They didn't connect at
all. You had very
all.
Contradictory personalities.
Absolutely, just like being a Jew and a Mormon didn't connect. I think, really, that was one of my first splits.
So what paid more for you, charging for sex or doing your act at comedy clubs?
Charging for sex. I had to do the comedy clubs for free for a while. Uh-huh. So that's why I don't really know why I did that, but I like that I was chasing men out of the feminist bookstore with a baseball bat and then changing in my car in the back and then walking down four blocks to hustle them. I mean, that's how horribly frightening my life was, and how out of control everything was, and how foreign everything was.
You write that sex became the most horrifying and disgusting thing in the world to you. Did it stop being that way when you stopped charging for it?
No, why I said that was because that was when my younger sister Stephanie called me from Salt Lake City and told me that our father had molested her. And that is when I started to act out sexually.
Mm-hmm.
But ironically, I still did not have the memories of my own sexual abuse for 10 more years. But I was acting out sexually right after that, when Stephanie, I said, get on a plane and come here. And she moved into my house in Denver when she was 17, and my mother signed over legal guardianship to me, because she did not want her home either. And, so then my mother and father could pretend that things had not happened. And Stephanie came to live with me for about 2 years, and then my other sister came also.
I want to get back to your performing. When you were given the opportunity to do a show and to base it on the persona that you'd created for your act, how did you want it to extend the kind of Roseanne personality into a sitcom? What was your vision of what that character should be?
Well, I wanted it to be the very same thing, just an outgrowth. And instead of telling stories about my three kids and my husband, I would show them.
Were there things that bugged you about the way mothers or wives or the working class or women in general had been portrayed on TV series?
Oh, yes, all of the above, and that's why I wanted to do what I do now, for exactly those reasons.
Did you have, like, particular things that really got to you, that particularly annoyed you, that you saw a lot on TV?
Well, everything you just said. Either mother was absent or she was an idiot and a total, like, enabler and nothing else, had no life, no mind, or she was dead. It was just so Disneyland and fairy tale and so white, and there was no class, and there was never any issues about class on television, which was funny because the big majority of people who watch television are working class, and that was never addressed, and everything was all pretending to be about striving to be come and have middle-class values and middle-class lives. And I wanted a show that made fun of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, it's so totally ridiculous to think that someone works as a waitress and lives in a great big house with, you know, I mean, it was all a lie.
I think it's fair to say that for the most part on TV, fat people have been played for laughs, the buffoon. Was it really important to you?
To be fat? Not really.
Well, not to be fat, but to be who you were and not be played for laughs because of your weight.
I never thought that was relevant at all. It was totally irrelevant to me because I had been fat and thin, and it never was any different, either one.
Your self-image wasn't changed either way?
No, right? Nothing in the world changed either way. And I thought, you know, when first people were, some of the first things that came out about the show was that, oh, this is a show about fat people. And that always kind of amazed me to how low the common denominator goes as far as people, what they get. But I just let it sit there because some people get things when they need to get things, and they get things on the level that they themselves think on. So to some people, it is just a show about fat people.
How would you sum up what it's about?
Well, it's a show about class,
mm-hmm,
and women.
You know, the interesting thing to me is that as you have gotten more and more successful, I mean wildly successful, your life has gotten further and further away from the life of the Roseanne character in the TV series. Yeah, I mean,
how do you know that?
Well, I mean, when you make the kind of money you make, you can no longer be working class. You can be working, but you
can't
be working
class. Well, does that just mean
that?
Well, does working class just mean how much money you make? See, that's part of the whole class issue that I want to talk about and address, because that is not true.
To what if it isn't about your life is?
It is a culture, and uh-huh, that is the culture I was raised in,
uh-huh,
and that's the culture I portray and will always be a part of, no matter what, because that's where I came from and it's who I am.
But still, though, I mean, your life really has become very different from the Roseanne character's life in the sense that she has to worry about making ends meet and starting a business, periods of unemployment, and stuff like that.
So do I.
Making ends meet?
Yes, of course. I have a big mortgage and a big house, but I still have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just because it's bigger doesn't mean that all that stuff is gone. And I do have to worry about work and how long it will last and if I'll work again after the show. And, you know, I have the same worries as anybody else, and so do all rich people, and that's just totally ridiculous.
I'm wondering, when you married Tom Arnold and you later decided to change your name,
uh-huh,
I'm wondering why you decided to change your name. And I ask that because, first of all, a lot of women don't do it in general anymore, mm-hmm, but usually particularly women in show business whose name has become their public name, even if they change their name in private, they often keep their name in public.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting decision on your part. And I'm wondering what was behind it.
I would prefer to have my husband's than my father's because I don't like my father. And I do not like that family, and I don't like that name. And I wanted that period of my life to be over, so when I changed my name to Arnold, I joined a new family.
Roseanne Arnold, she's written a new memoir called My Lives. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the theology of violence. We talk with Israeli political scientist Ehud Sprinzak about the late Meir Kahani and the movement he led. Baruch Goldstein, who massacred Palestinians in a mosque last week, was one of Kahani's followers. Sprinzak is an expert on extremist politics in Israel and is the author of the book The Ascendance of Israel's Radical Right. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new series about family life, The Birds of Paradise and The Road Home. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The French general in charge of the United Nations forces in the former Yugoslavia said today if the international community doesn't send 10,000 more troops to Bosnia, all that's been achieved so far will be lost. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
In a fist-banging interview on French radio, General Jean Cotte said if the 10,000 extra troops are not sent immediately, the UN would risk losing all it's done in Sarajevo. Kant said the UN had stretched itself in sending 1,500 new troops to the Bosnian capital. We have no more available now, he said. Kant called on France and Britain, which have the largest forces in Bosnia, to send more forces. He also called on the United States to contribute troops. President Bill Clinton has said that the U.S. would consider taking part in the peacekeeping mission in Bosnia once the warring factions have signed a peace treaty. Cott said the refusal of the U.S. to send troops before that was not a very courageous attitude. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Yet another severe winter storm is thrashing the Northeast today. Snow, sleet, and freezing rain are closing schools, snapping power lines, and causing people to wonder if spring will ever come. At least four deaths have been blamed on the newest storm since yesterday. Wind gusts have been clocked up to 50 miles per hour at several sites. Airports have been closed in several major cities, and up to 300,000 people on the eastern seaboard have been without electricity. Winter storm warnings are up from Kentucky to West Virginia to New England. The White House is apologizing for contacts between banking officials and White House staffers in the Whitewater investigation. A special counsel is looking into the matter, which involves a failed Arkansas savings and loan. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The latest twist in the Whitewater case involves allegedly improper contacts between White House staff and officials at the federal agency charged with dealing with failed savings and loans. White House Communications Director Mark Guerin acknowledged today that the meetings may have appeared improper and that Chief of Staff Mac McClarty will be issuing a memo warning staff about attending similar meetings. In one of the meetings, the White House counsel, Bernard Nussbaum, was told that the Clintons had been named in a criminal referral by the SNL agency. Criminal referrals are not usually discussed with any of their subjects. The savings and loan under investigation was owned by James McDougal, an Arkansas businessman with whom the president and his wife had a real estate partnership called Whitewater. Investigators are trying to determine whether taxpayer-backed funds from McDougal's SNL were improperly diverted to Whitewater or to then-Governor Clinton's campaign fund. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost just over 7 points to end at 3,824. Declines led advances by a margin of nearly 4-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Clinton administration says more than 1 million children had no place to live during the 1980s, and about a third of them did not attend school regularly. The new figures also put the total homeless population at between 5 and 9.5 million people. Past administrations had estimated the figure at just 600,000. The latest report is expected to evolve into the administration's plan for helping the homeless. Russia has begun cutting off gas supplies to the former Soviet republics of Ukraine and Belarus. Moscow says they haven't paid back bills worth hundreds of millions of dollars. The BBC's Robert Parsons reports from Moscow.
The cessation of deliveries would have particularly serious consequences for the Ukrainian economy, which is already suffering acute energy shortages. Kyiv's inability to pay stems from Russia's decision to start trading its oil and gas at world prices. That's put an unbearable strain on Ukraine, which is heavily dependent on Russian gas. It's not the first time Russia has cut supplies because of problems over payments. But in the past, many Ukrainian businesses managed to get around the problem by siphoning off gas from the pipeline which supplies Russian fuel to Western Europe. This time, Russia has signaled that that won't happen. Gazprom said that if it receives any evidence that Ukrainian factories are siphoning off gas, it'll close the pipeline altogether. But if it does that, Russia will also suffer. 90% of the gas it sends to Western Europe is fed through Ukraine.
Robert Parsons reporting. The government says orders to U.S. factories rose 2.1% in January. The government says orders for transportation goods led the way. In a second report, the Labor Department says the number of Americans filing first-time claims for unemployment fell by 57,000 last week. That's the lowest level since Christmas. Analysts say a shortened holiday work week helped the decline. Jobless claims for the last 4 weeks also fell sharply. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Baruch Goldstein, the doctor who massacred Palestinians at a Hebron mosque last week, was part of a larger movement of extremists. My guest, Ehud Sprinzak, is one of Israel's leading experts on extremism and violence. He's a professor of political science at Hebrew University and author of the book The Ascendance of Israel's Radical Right. The Middle East peace talks are on hold as a result of the massacre. The PLO has said it won't return to the table unless Israel disarms the Jewish settlers in the occupied territories. Goldstein was a settler in the West Bank. Earlier today, we called Sprinzak in Jerusalem and asked him to explain Israel's policy on arms for Jewish settlers in the territories.
Ever since 1967 and the occupation, it has been a standing order that if you go to the occupied territories, because of the danger of terrorism, you have to carry guns. It is not just privilege, it's an obligation and a duty. And the reason that settlers carry guns is not because they're going to attack so much as to defend themselves. And the vast majority of the settlers are not that aggressive. They've not been involved in anything closer to what Goldstein's did. So I guess there is a sentiment that we shouldn't lump Goldstein with the entire settler community here.
So is it the army that gives the guns to settlers?
Yeah,
before they go?
It is the army. I mean, in addition, individuals can buy handguns on their own. But settlers who have served in the army, and as you know, every young man in Israel since the age of 18 is required to serve in the army. For those people, they can get guns from the army.
And just to clarify, when a settler moves to the territories, are they given a gun by the government? Or are they just allowed to keep the gun that they have from their military service?
No. They are given a gun by the military. Israeli soldiers do not keep their arms at home. So if you live in an area, and especially if it is a very sensitive area, not, by the way, much of the settlements and the majority of the settlers live very close to the old border and not in the vicinity of Arab neighborhoods and Arab villages, so they don't need those guns. But those who live far away in sensitive areas are required to hold the guns.
So the guns are issued for self-protection?
Basically, yes.
What are the settlers' fears about being disarmed?
Well, exactly what I told you. I mean, there is great Arab animosity, Palestinian animosity, and there is a fear that they will be attacked. In terms of terrorism, the volume of Palestinian terrorism has been quite high. So the fear is to be hurt.
Would it be possible for you to say what percentage of settlers in the territories are actually militant and extremists or vigilantes?
Well, we have to make several distinctions. The most extreme and violent, and as a matter of fact, even terroristic, are very few, and they are the members of the organization that has been involved in the recent massacre or Goldstein was a member of. These are the followers of the late Rabbi Kahane. Their numbers is very small, and the hardcore of them is not more than few dozen. Then they have some supporters, like few hundreds. But the rest of the settler community may be opposed to the peace process, may be ready to demonstrate, even to challenge the government, but they're not murderers in that respect, and would not do anything close to what Goldstein did.
Did you keep tabs on Goldstein in your studies of the radical right? Did you know about him?
Well, I knew about him, but I didn't know him. He was not the typical activist, a violent activist. You know that he was the doctor of the community. And I didn't expect anybody like it, certainly not Goldstein, to be involved in this massacre. I think he must have gone, in addition to the ideology and the group feeling and everything else, he must have gone through a personal crisis. Something broke down in him, which led him to do this. But he was not the typical mass killer that one expects, if at all.
What do you mean he wasn't typical? You mean because he was a doctor? Or?
Yeah, he was saving people. Most of the time, his job was to save people. And I have seen on television an Arab who couldn't believe that he was involved in the murder because he saved his life a few months earlier.
That's interesting, because I had heard that Dr. Goldstein wouldn't treat Arabs.
Well, there were cases in which he refused. I mean, there was some kind of contradiction in this person. And to this very day, I have not heard a full account or a full analysis of his personality. So at certain points, he said he would not treat Arabs. But at the same time, we have evidence to the contrary. So in any way, people who knew him thought he was a very sensitive guy until it came to the ideology and to the matter of, like, the collective danger of the Arabs.
How did Kiryat Arba, the community that Goldstein lived in, become a center for militant activities, settler militant activities?
Well, I will tell you. From the beginning, when Jews came to Hebron, when the settlers came back to Hebron in 1968, there was kind of blood in the air because of the bitter memories of the massacre of the Jewish community of Hebron in 1929. So the people that returned did not just return in order to rehabilitate a Jewish ancient place. They also returned to make a point. And there was always a sense of revenge. So people who were less radical would not go to such a place. And there are lots of settlements in the occupied territories. I mean, if you want to become a settler, you don't have to go to the most sensitive and extreme place. But that particular place attracted the more radical elements. Then in the mid-70s, Rabbi Meir Kahana has called upon his followers to go and settle in Kiryat Arba. And quite a few of them did, including some American followers of him. And so there was a culture created in the area which spelled out radicalism, extremism, very strong anti-Arab sense, and a feeling, I would say, even of a need for revenge. So as I said, the more people came to the territories, the more radical elements who wanted to make a point that this is all ours, that this is fully Jewish, and we cannot forgive and we cannot forget, went to that place. So it's kind of a slow process through which a culture of extremism was created.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ehud Sprinzak, and he's the author of the book The Ascendance of Israel's Radical Right. He's a professor of political science at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and he's speaking to us from his home. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ehud Sprinzak, who is an expert on the rise of Israel's radical right. Mara Kahane founded an extremist group in the United States before he settled in Israel in 1971. In your book, The Ascendance of Israel's Radical Right, you write that Kahane's most notorious ideological contribution was the glorification of Jewish violence. What do you mean by that?
I mean exactly what I say. I mean, I studied Rabbi Kahane for many years, including many talks with him. And I came to the conclusion that the strongest drive in his life was a sense of strong identification with the Jewish humiliation and persecution throughout 2,000 years of diaspora. Kahane could not forget and could not forgive for a single moment in his life of what was done to Jews, from pogroms to persecutions to finally gassing them in the Holocaust. And he had this urge for revenge. Now, around this urge, he produced a theology of violence, which spelled out that if in the past the Gentiles, when they wanted to desecrate the name of God, attacked his people, desecrated them, killed them, then now Jews responding, meaning it is sanctification of the name of God. So this element of revenge, around this element of revenge, a whole theology and also a system of education was built, according to which it is glorious, even holy, for a Jew to attack a Gentile who is in one way or another hostile to him. And what Kahane did, in addition to writing about this many times, is to try and produce in his Jewish Defense League, the American organization, even before he came to Israel, he tried to produce a new type of Jew, a young Jew who would not feel guilty about using violence. So in this respect, we are talking about a unique, not just a theology of violence, but even a system of socialization. Followers of Rabbi Kahane, and I'm afraid that one of them was Goldstein, were told when you confront these guys, especially if they have something against you, don't feel guilty. And this explains, in my judgment, the applauding of the act of the massacre of Friday after the fact. Usually you do not expect people to admit that they're pleased by such horrible act.
Do you have a sense of what it was socially or politically that enabled Kahane's extremist thoughts to catch on in a small segment of the Israeli population?
Well, I have to tell you, it didn't catch on. Kahane became popular. You know, he was elected to Israeli parliament in 1984. He became popular not because of this theology, which only his immediate followers were aware of, so much as for his anti-Arab propaganda and the call for expulsion of all Arabs from Palestine, from the land of Israel. Now, this was something which, it's the dream of every Israeli, you know, just to have a clean country. And I guess simple-minded, unhappy people about other things liked that idea. This made Kahane popular. Also, he was very good in taking an anti-establishment style, appealing to the downtrodden, the lower middle class, the losers in Israeli society. And this made him popular, not so much the theology of violence, which was shared by a few people, but unfortunately, even a few is too many.
Could you give us a brief overview of other strains of religious and secular extremism now in the territories?
Well, there is another movement, which is basically the most influential movement, which is called Gush Emunim, the Block of the Faithful. I write a great deal about them in my book. They have a different approach to the methods and the way of dealing with Arabs. I mean, they share the Kahane belief, Jewish fundamentalist belief, that all the land is ours, that it will be a rebellion against God to give back, and basically the people of Israel cannot be redeemed unless the entire territory is in Jewish hands. But when it comes to the methods, they are a lot more traditional. That is to say, when they speak about violence, they only speak in terms of self-defense. They're restrained. They're not for the expulsion of all Arabs. It's not that they're moderate. They're very much against the peace process, and they're very angry at the government, and they refuse to recognize the PLO or anything like it. But their modus operandi, the way they do things, the way they behave, is totally different.
How much power do you think the radical right in Israel has now to derail the peace process?
Well, let me put it this way. When I spoke to you in 1991, they had a lot more power because in addition to the numbers, they had a very supportive government. And for the Likud government in 1991 and for several years, they were really the darlings of the camp. They were the Zionists of our days. Now, this is no longer the case. Right now, the Israeli people have turned its back, and it has now supported a very liberal and moderate government. Now, under those conditions, the same number of people who once could have exerted a lot more influence are in a much tougher situation. As a matter of fact, they're more isolated than ever before, and they're very unhappy. This is why I think that politically they are in no position to subvert the peace process. The only thing that could help them, and this is why this massacre, in addition to the human side, horrible human side, is dangerous politically, the only thing that could help them is violence. Because if tensions go up, if Jewish extremists and Arab extremists kill each other, they could create a sense of insecurity in the community, which would consequently have reduced the support of the Israeli people of the government.
What do you think of the PLO proposal to disarm all the settlers in the territories?
Well, I can understand the feelings of the PLO, but this is unrealistic, politically speaking. In addition to what I've already said about the fact that the settlers need those arms for self-defense, this government would not get the support of the Israeli people for such an act. So it's impossible. It's just unrealistic. It's an idea. And I would suggest to the PLO to let the Israeli government do what they can and move fast into the peace process. Because if the peace process moves fast, then, of course, many of these things would not be required because there would be soon a Palestinian autonomy.
Ehud Sprinzak is a professor of political science at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's the author of The Ascendance of Israel's Radical Right. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we have a report from Mara Liasson on the White House and comments on white water. Noah Adams will be talking about the Denver airport, which was supposed to open in March and will instead open in May because the baggage handling system doesn't seem to work. A Kentucky congressman's long-standing record of never missing a vote in the House ended today, and we'll talk a little bit about that. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General John Shalikashvili, talked to our Pentagon correspondent about Bosnia today, and we will be revisiting Taft High School, talking to students there.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A lot of new TV series are being rolled out this month, including two new dramas premiering this week, ABC's The Birds of Paradise, which premieres tonight, and CBS's The Road Home, which premieres Saturday. TV critic David Bianculli says that both of them have ties to previous well-regarded dramas and also have the same problem.
This is going to be the year of family values on TV, or at least it'll start out that way until a lot of these well-meaning shows go into the tank. The surprise success of Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman, a show I still can't believe is a hit, is one reason the networks are developing so many wholesome TV series. The other big reason is the debate over TV violence. So put them together, and you have the ideal incubator for the type of family drama that's about to pop up all over the tube. The Birds of Paradise is about a recent widower with three children who packs up the kids and the dog and moves to Hawaii. The Road Home is about a man and woman with four kids who pack them up and head for North Carolina to visit the grandparents and decide to stay. Both shows sound instantly forgettable, but the producers and stars make you want to give them a chance. The widower in Birds of Paradise is played by Timothy Busfield, who played Elliot on 30-something. The creators of the show have good credentials, too. One worked on Moonlighting, the other on St. Elsewhere. So you expect a lot. But what you get in the first two shows is a sort of Southern exposure. There are lots of quirky characters, who are played well by the likes of Bruce Weitz and Arlo Guthrie. But there's also a lot of overly dramatic writing, like in this scene, where Busfield's character takes the kids on an outdoor hike and stops to talk to the spirit of his dead wife.
Here we are, Holly, in Hawaii, standing on top of an active volcano. It's your birthday. We're celebrating by making an offering to Pele. You love these islands. She's the one who made them. We're trying to be a family without you, honey. But it's hard.
I'm not giving up on this show because some of the scenes and performances are good. But all the conflicts are resolved in a manner that's way too pat, which is the exact same problem with The Road Home. You know, going in, how everything is going to come out. But again, the lineage of the show is something special. The Road Home is created by Bruce Paltrow and John Tinker, two more senior producers of St. Elsewhere. And they use two of that show's best cast members, Terrence Knox and Ed Flanders, as the leading men of The Road Home. Then, as leading ladies, they went out and got two great ones, Frances Sternhagen and Karen Allen. And though the plots are obvious, the interaction between characters is a lot less forced. Here's a mother-daughter talk between Karen Allen as Allison and her daughter Darcy, played by Jessica Bowman. Darcy is taking a bubble bath, and Mom comes in for a little bath-time bonding.
Mom, did anything this humiliating ever happen to you?
Once, in church during silent prayer, I let one go loud.
Really?
Everybody had their head bowed and just sort of slipped out.
What happened?
Someone said, amen.
I'm not against family values in general, and I'm not against either of these shows in particular. I'm glad they're not worse, but I sure wish they were better, and I'll give them the chance to grow. Wholesome doesn't have to mean dull. Although the more of these shows I watch, the tougher it is to remember that.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Audrey Voblaitis. Anne Neville and Devin Reif are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.